श्रील गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री श्री गोराधा माधव की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि वो। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, वेलकम, गुड आफ्टरनून, थैंक्स फॉर कमिंग ऑल ऑफ यू आल्सो ऑनलाइन कंपनी गाइस। So today we have some unscheduled event, but we somehow try to announce that on time, so whoever may like to come, some inspiration and availability was there for making one last meeting on this side of North. Our self-acknowledging, we may have questions, having the courage to present the questions and having the integrity to open for answers and whatever may manifest for all of us to continue growing as individuals and as community as well. So that said, I don't know if there are any questions or topics, something you may like to ask about today. I think Bhakti Rasa has something.
One of my questions is concerning inherency, non-inherency of bhakti and the jiva.
What are yours? Yeah.
So in a recent, I think, class by Swami Kripurari Guru Maharaj, he was saying how the jiva, in Golok, the jiva is non-different from their body. Mm-hmm. So to me that seems to give weight to inherency, because if the body is non-different from the jiva, it seems like that's something that should already be there. It's an identity that is non-different than the jiva, so it seems to lend weight towards that side of the.
Mm-hmm. So what to do with the book?
Read it more.
Okay. Yeah. So can you bring 1 second the book? So I think the question was heard, but just in case I briefly repeat it for those online. So here Bhakti Rasa is asking that our Guru Maharaj recently has mentioned how the spiritual body, when the jiva attains, receives the spiritual body, that spiritual body is not different from one's eternal identity, so that lends itself to think in terms of bhakti being inherent, in the sense of, okay, you are not different from that identity who is eternal, so that's already there, so if it's there, it's there. So how to understand that in that connection. So to begin with, I would like to share a few verses, some of them I know, but some of them don't, so I will go straight to the the source here. So this is from chapter 6 of Inherent or Inherited. Here it is. And chapter 6 is called The Source of Our Siddha Deha. So basically I try to, in this chapter, to address the situation of not only if bhakti is inherent or not, but prem, rasa, siddha deha, which are different ways of speaking in one sense about one similar reality, but from different, slightly different angles. So to begin with, I wanted just to share from here some few verses which clearly show that the Siddha Deha, which is basically the perfected body, means Siddha Deha, or sometimes called spiritual body, is bestowed upon us. With very clear words. The most famous verse comes from first canto of the Bhagavatam, 6th chapter, when Narada Muni is describing his trajectory and how he was converted, if you will, from being, well, many birds we know about Narada Muni before being Narada Muni, but when he becomes officially Narada Muni, if you will, he says in 28th verse of 6th chapter, 1st canto, prayujamani manitam sudham bhagavatim tanum arabda karma nirvanu nyapatat pancha bhautikaham. So he says, having been awarded a transcendental body, befitting an associate of the personality of Godhead, the body made of five material elements with karmas relating to the present body fell away. So here it's very clearly the Prayujamane refers to having been awarded. So, of course, if you are awarded something means you don't have it. Vishwanath Chakravartakur basically in his explanation says, at the time of being made to accept a body that was Sudha Sattva, because it was not a material body, and because it belonged to the Lord, my material body fell away. And his Krama Sandarbha commentary, Srila Jiva Goswami says, the Siddha Deha is brought by the Lord. So that's, at least for me, pretty clear. And interestingly, also in this verse, there is one word that is tam. So the word tam here in Sanskrit refers like to that. So it's a pronoun to refer to a spiritual body. And in Sanskrit, the word tam is used as a term to refer to things which are like not in one's proximity and not in one's vision. That, like if you say bring that thing. Mm-hmm. If I say bring this, means it's closer. Mm-hmm. So in Sanskrit they have similar terms like that. Imam has to do with something. He refers with the word imam to his physical body. So imam means this physical body. And tam refers that Siddha Deha, no, which is not here basically. Okay, I won't read the whole thing. But just two more verses to share some further proof in case. So there's another verse. Well, in the previous verse to the one I quoted, which is verse 627 of the same chapter, Narada says, O Brahmana Vyasa, when I concentrated only on Krishna, not attached to material enjoyment and pure in mind, the time of receiving my spiritual body occurred simultaneously with that of giving up my material body, like lightning flashing simultaneously with lightning. So, what else? One more from Gajendra. And Gajendra was liberated from the curse of being in that elephant body and so on. 6.2.43 of the Bhagavatam. Hitva kalivaram tirti gangayam darshanadanu sadhya sarupam jagrihe bhagavat parshavartinam. After seeing those forms, he gave up his body at this holy place of the Ganges and immediately attained a spiritual body as an associate of the Lord. And one more body. One more verse, 8.3.19 from the Bhagavatam also, says, persons desiring dharma, artha, kama, and moksha worship the Lord and attain the desired destination. What to speak of other benedictions? They also receive, apnubhamti is the word, a spiritual body. May that Lord of unlimited mercy liberate me and bestow such a spiritual body. So, that many verses. I don't want to torture you with one evidence after another. One more torture. Little one. Chaitanya Charitamrita. Chaitanya Charitamrita from Ramananda Sambhad. Braja is famous one. Braja lo kira kona bhava lanya jai bhaja bhava jogya diha pana Krishna paya braja. Whoever accepts the feelings of the resident of Braj and engages in bhajan appropriate for that bhava receives a body suitable for it and attains Sri Krishna in Braj. In this way, not very many, there are some other here, but I'll stop there. So, for this, from this Shastric evidence, we find very clearly that the expression is always receiving, attaining, being given, and all these type of expressions referring to something which is not in proximity. So, it's clear that the Siddha Deha is not something inherent in the Jiva, of course, because Bhakti is not. And the Siddha Deha is made of Bhakti, if you want to put it. No? It's Sudha Sattva, as it is said here, Swarup Shakti. So since Swarup Shakti is not inherent in the constitution of the Tathasta Shakti, therefore, a body who is fully made of Swarup Shakti is not made, it's not inherent in the Tathasta Shakti. So that, say, that first point made clear, of course, the question has to do with, okay, but why then we hear these expressions like such of, that when you attain or when you receive that body, you are not different from that. In what sense you are not different? No, it's important like to also understand the nuanced expression of, in this case, Guru Maharaj, of sometimes other sadhus who may say something different. Because again, if it's clear it's not inherent, so in which sense you are non-different from that. So the idea, and Guru Maharaj has said that many times as well, that when you attain that identity, or when you receive whatever the verb you want to use, that identity is, if you will, perfectly fitting to who you are in eternity, who you want to be in eternity. No? Who you are as a Tathagata Shakti in combination with Swarup Shakti. No, I mean, you are as a Sadaka, you don't have a Siddha Deha, you have Sadaka Deha, but Swarup Shakti starts to dawn more and more considerably in you, to the point that gradually a certain particular goal, service, inspiration, and everything becomes more and more and more specific, to the point that an identity is required for all that specificity to be fulfilled in Lila, basically. No? So at the moment you reach that point, naturally, that identity is there, if you will. That Swarup Shakti will descend in such a way that you will be there, if you will. No? That's at the stage of Asakti, as Guru Maharaj explains in his commentary on Sikshastakam. In Asakti, you receive this like glimpse or awakening of awakening. I mean, try to follow my terms. Now, you experience, as it may be like that, no? Of who you are in eternity. You have a glimpse of that, and eventually you culture that further through sadhana by the guidance of the guru. So the point is that identity is so perfectly befitting all your longings and all your projections for so much, so long, it's like totally natural, like, oh, that's me, basically, no? Like for example, and that's the point of, we don't have bhakti, but we have the potential to attain bhakti. And Tathagata Shakti needs to be defined according to its potential. That's a very crucial point that sometimes is not so easy to understand. Okay, we don't have Siddha Deha, we don't have Prem, we don't have Bhava, we don't have Rasa, we don't have Siddha Deha, and so on. But we have the potential to attain that. So in consideration of our potential, who we are is inseparable from our potential, basically. No? So my point is that we cannot think about ourselves totally isolated from all that we can be. No? So all that we can be means Siddha Deha. No? That's all that you can be. And that's all that we can be, all our potential. So in that sense, and we are not different from our potential. So in that sense, it's reaching that point or receiving that Siddha Deha feels like, it's me. Because that's included in all we can be under a particular shelter of the Swarup Shakti. Guru Maharaj will give the ideas like when you go to a shop and you, I would say, you try like a suit, huh? and the owner of the shop will tell you, will look at you and say like, that's you. No? Maybe that's not you, but he wants to sell the suit. So, with at least one suit, he will say that. No? Maybe he will say, try it now, try. That's you. No? So Guru Maharaj will give this idea. No, I mean, it's not that the suit is inherent to you, but, oh, that's like, that's you. It suits you, and that's you in your best possible version in ordinary terms in this case, no, in mundane aesthetics. So the point is that when you receive your Siddha Deha, if you want to speak as a Siddha Deha, as a divine suit, it feels like yours. It feels like you. It's like when a jiva attains, let's say, Golok, it feels like, it's not that you feel, oh, it took so long to come here, and you remember all your previous life. You don't have any memories because there's no samskara, material samskaras, no mundane citta, like saving all those samskaras. So you cannot just be in Golok Vrindavan and, oh, but my previous lifetime I did, it's there. So it feels like sometimes called eternal present. So in that sense, it's like, okay, it's here. I am, it's me. You won't even be thinking in terms of my Siddha Deha. No? So that said, interestingly, our acharyas do not express in terms of, I mean, the point that it's also mentioned is that when we reach the Siddhadeha, let's say, it's not that our condition, when we became fully, let's say, engrossed in bhakti, in those advanced stages, our tatastha shakti constitution is not changing. It's not that we stop being tatastha jiva shakti and we become swarup shakti. No. We become fully engrossed and how do you say, like, imbibed, embraced by swarup shakti, but still we remain tatastha shakti. So, Jiva Goswami uses the term tadatmya. Tadatmya means in Sanskrit like, how do you say, like sameness. I don't know if that word exists. Mm-hmm. Sameness. Not oneness. Mm-hmm. Oneness will be ekatva. So ekatva means you become one. Totally one. So you become whatever. Your body. But tadatmya means sameness. Sameness refers to you are totally embraced by Swarup Shakti. It feels like you. But still you remain tatastha jiva. Mm-hmm. And the example given for tadatmya, for this sameness, is the iron rod put into the fire. Mm-hmm. So it remains into the fire. At one point, the iron rod acquires all the attributes of the fire. As long as it remains in the fire. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you reach Golok, you remain to the fire. Nobody falls from Vaikuntha. But the example is, if hypothetically speaking, you put the iron rod outside the fire, the iron rod becomes fire, iron rod again. So we are tatastha again, we are a product of the environment. No. If we put ourselves under the shelter of Swarup Shakti, we become Swarup Shakti-like. Although we remain tatastha Shakti, the iron rod remains iron rod in the fire. But it acquires all those qualities, almost you can say, wow, it burned, oh, it's giving light, oh, it's all the prop. It's fire. No, it's non-different, iron rod from fire. Non-different, but different, no? So that's also part of for the Veda-Veda equation here, no? So in that same way, when one receives a Siddhadeha, we are so much into the fire of Swarup Shakti that we operate in a Swarup Shakti-like dynamic, although we eternally remain Tatastha Shakti. But in the dynamics of the Lila, you may not be able to tell the difference. Oh, there goes a Tadastha Shakti, there goes a Swarup Shakti associate. Because there are personalities in the Lila who are not Tatastha Jivas. No? Yashoda, Nanda, Madhu Mangal, all of them are not Tatastha Jivas, but they are Swarup Shakti, Parisats, associates. But again, in the how they operate in the Lila, I mean, it's like if almost all of them are, again, Swarup Shakti fire-like. But still, this difference remains. From our point of view here, again, in the Lila, nobody is like pinpointing, okay, Tatastha Shakti, Swarup, I mean, they don't even know about those terms. They're uncivilized. Transcendentally uncivilized. No? So basically, that will be the idea of mentioning, okay, the Siddhadeha is non-different from us. Because again, at that point, the Tatastha Shakti, who is again prone to be nourished by the environment, became so much nourished by Swarup Shakti to such a degree that Tatastha constitution attains its highest prospect and potential and becomes fully compatible. I mean, we are more compatible with Swarup Shakti than with Maya Shakti, although we have experience of trying to be nourished by Maya Shakti's influence, malnourished, but what to do? No. But it's not that compatible. But when we try to expose our Tatastha constitution to Swarup Shakti, that becomes much more compatible. And when that's done fully and perfectly, it is like if, again, iron rod in the fire, non-difference. So in that sense, we are non-different from that body. Because also, yeah, our Tatastha constitution became totally like engrossed by Swarup Shakti, and that combination is the most perfect, the ultimate combination for us, which allows, I mean, that shows how compatible we are with Swarup Shakti. It allows for receiving an identity of Swarup Shakti and and combining with us in a tadamya way, in a sameness for eternity. Mm-hmm. So basically that will be the idea. But I will say that, yeah, Guru Maharaj was mostly speaking about also like the subjective experience of someone there, as I mentioned, you know, like, I'm here, this is me, eternal present, and so on, you know, which is also part of the equation from us speaking from here, you know, what's how one feels being there, and so on. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, some ideas. Any other question? Go on, Narayan.
So I was going to ask if are there other Gaudiya Sampradayas besides Bhaktivinoda that are active today that are considered legitimate, and what do they do?
That may take a few weeks to reply that question. There were like four questions in one. We have to cancel some journeys and future journeys. Sorry, all of them there on Chapel Hill, but speak with Guru Narayan. So again, are there any other, I repeat also for those who have not heard, are there any other Gaudiya expressions apart from Bhaktivinoda Parivar that are bona fide? And if so,
are they active?
Are they active, and how they are active? Something like that. Okay. Yeah, that invites for a big discussion because it's lots of historical details and information. But yeah, to begin with, I will say yes, of course. Although, unfortunately, I'm sure that maybe some other people, if you are asked the same question, they may say no. Only the Bhaktivinoda Parivar is a bona fide. Among the Bhaktivinoda Parivar, only our particular mission is the bona fide. And among our mission, only my guru is the bona fide. And among my gurudev, basically, I am the only bona fide disciple. No, you may not say that overtly, but if you continue playing out that equation, it converges in Hamma Meti, no? I mean mine. But that's not. I do not agree with that. There are many Gaudiya Vaishnav branches, expressions, many, many more than what we can imagine. Of course, some of them may be considered by some as apasampradayas. Some of them may not considered by some as apasampradayas. That's the whole. I mean, we may say in the Bhaktivinoda Parivar there are such group is apasampradaya, and they may say the same about us for some particular reasons.
Meaning not.
Apasampradaya means like not. Okay. Yeah, not basically part of the real deal, and somehow heterodox and deviated in some elements or something, which again it's unfortunate in one sense. Of course, if you study the whole history of Gaudiya Sampradaya from the very beginnings, from Mahaprabhu, I've been reading some stuff recently about that, and it's interesting because there is much more diversity of that one you can imagine. No? Mm-hmm. And I'm someone who is relatively familiar with a good degree of the diversity in our Parivar, but I was nonetheless surprised about how much more of that was there. Mm-hmm. Was there, is there, from almost day one, no, of the Sampradaya. Because sometimes we tend to only think, okay, the diversity came, I don't know, when Prabhupada passed away. Before that, all one. No. No. And when I say diversity, I'm not saying that in a negative sense also,
right.
No?
Right.
So even from Mahaprabhu's times, no? Mahaprabhu's times when Mahaprabhu was even here and eventually when he passed away, I'm just summarizing because, again, this we can recommend some further lectures and reading eventually. But from Mahaprabhu's times, it is very generally clearly established some at least two currents to begin with. I mean, there are more than two, but we have the currents of Vrindavan and the current of Navadvip, no? With different nuanced modes in how the presentation was developed. No? The Goswamis in Vrindavan, not writing in Sanskrit, developing the whole theology, ontology on Vrindavan, the Vrindavan side. And on Navadvip, for example, Nityananda Prabhu, the Dwadasa Gopals, just knocking on the door, you know, uprooting trees and dancing with crocodiles and Bengali tigers and just crying and bhajagauranga, kahagauranga, lahagauranga, and emphasizing the worship of Mahaprabhu on a way that was not mentioned by the Goswamis, at least overtly. And again, the way that the devotees in Bengal were preached was mostly in Bengali, maybe with some other types of perceptions about Mahaprabhu, and in between that were different currents, some of them who were more attracted to see Mahaprabhu in terms of him being Krishna, some others who felt more attracted according to seeing him in terms of Radha-bhav. The Goswamis almost did not speak about Mahaprabhu directly. Mm-hmm. So at that, I'm just speaking in one layer, one generation, just to show there were some notorious differences, just the first immediate group. Line of immediate associate of Mahaprabhu. So you can imagine from that on so many things. For example, regarding the biographies of Mahaprabhu, there are seven main biographies of Mahaprabhu, and many of them appeared with some 10-15 years of difference. The very first one from Murari Gupta, who presents Mahaprabhu in more Vishnu-like terms, his god and Yuga avatar. And then comes other biographies by Kavi Karnapur, who slightly starts to introduce the idea of Krishna, and gradually Radha. Then Lochan Das Thakur, who kind of many take him more for the side of Gaur Nagar, of seeing Mahaprabhu as the beloved of Navadvip, and even having romantic affairs with other ladies, which is not played out in the Chaitanya Mangal of Lochan Das, but in other books of his, at least attributed to his to him, called Damali and some others. That's pretty explicit there. And then coming Vrindavan Das Thakur's Chaitanya Bhagavat, which still depicts Mahaprabhu in more the Lord of Vaikuntha and terms like that. And then almost like one century after, interestingly, so it's also interesting to study history and see how Sampradaya and the official stance in certain things that today we entertain about Mahaprabhu, how they were like actually being developed in time and established. So eventually, for example, Chaitanya Charitamrita represented like the official orthodoxy about Mahaprabhu, which was kind of universally accepted by all the Vaishnavas. And that happened in one famous festival called the Kittery Gram Festival. Very, very famous festival where it is said sometimes that Gaur Purnim was celebrated there for the first time, although Mahaprabhu had passed away some years back already. But there were Narottam Das, Srinivas Acharya, Samananda Prabhu, and Janavi Devi. And there kind of that's it, like the parallel with in Christianity you find with the Council of Nicaea, you say? Mm-hmm. Where like the official orthodoxy of Christianity was like established in that meeting. So the parallel to that in Gaudiya Vaishnavism happened in this Kethuri festival, where Chaitanya Charitamrita was kind of enshrined. Okay, this is the common understanding about Mahaprabhu in our Gaudiya Sampradaya. And there were different groups being reunited in that festival. Again, different branches. And as Chaitanya Charitamrita describes, there was the Advaita Parivar, Gadhadhar Parivar, Nityananda Parivar, Srinivas Acharya Parivar, Shyamananda Parivar, Narottam Parivar, all these different families or lineages coming. So all this before Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I mentioned, you know, just to have a glimpse about, there were lots of varieties and modes, and after that, as you may know, Before that, Gopal Guru Goswami, who was an associate of Mahaprabhu, for example, just for you to have an idea of how some things appeared in time in the Sampradaya, which were not there officially established during Mahaprabhu's time. Gopal Guru Goswami and his disciple, Dhyanachandra Goswami, they composed these padatis, or these main manuals for meditation, Gaur Govind Darshana Padati. when they will present more this idea of Ashtakaliya Lila, Smaranam, and Ekadasrabhav, these 11 ingredients that made one's Siddhadeha, when the guru sometimes reveals that to the disciples, who nowadays is almost universally established on the lines of sometimes called all the traditional parivars, like lines from Nityananda Parivar, Advaita. Like for many of their lines, it's like at one point you have to receive that from the guru. No, those the ingredients that compose your Siddhadeha, you have to engage in meditating on the Ashtakaliya Lila in the context of Raganuga Bhajan. But that was not officially clearly mentioned by Mahaprabhu nor the Goswami Granta, but started with Gopal Guru Goswami, Dhyanachandra Goswami. And interestingly, this current of practice or this way of addressing sadhana mostly started in Jagannath Puri. So that's another place. And Vrindavan, now the Jagannath Puri. Nowadays, mainly you will find this type of current in Vrindavan, in Radhakund, and other places. But it all came mostly from Jagannath Puri. And Jagannath Puri is another planetary system altogether. You know, how they do certain things, how Jagannath is worshipped, and how different cultural elements also enter into play. So all this happening again, centuries before Thakur Bhaktivinoda, and many of those lineages who came from these different associates of Mahaprabhu still, of course, exist nowadays. Lineages coming from Advaita Acharya, Nityananda Prabhu, Gadadhar Pandit, Narottam Thakur, Shyamananda Prabhu. So you go to Vrindavan, there are different temples, they are in charge of those temples. They have, I mean, I'm not saying that every single expression of that line, those lines are totally bona fide, because I don't know. I mean, I've not been just knocking every door and testing who am I to do that, but I can tell you that they are, of course, very, very genuine expressions of those things and very bona fide practitioners, although they may do things, some of them, differently on some level. Again, no, I'm not saying that they are extremely so different that you don't have anything in common and you're like, who are you? Totally different. I mean, in heart, we are still members of, in the bigger picture, we all belong to Gaur Parivar, Mahaprabhu's family. Now that, inside that family, oh, so many sub-families and ways of doing. And again, sometimes it's unfortunate. Some devotees, generally most of them immature, will be the ones like just fighting because how they do this detail and this ritual and this mantra and just, oh, this he's deviated because of doing like this, and the other one will counteract in the same way instead of focusing what we have in common as part of the Gaur Parivar. So those type of things are there. And and in time, I will say the distance has become a little bit even more abyss-like with the appearance of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and especially with the appearance of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. And of course, I'm not blaming them by that. I'm just making this objective remark. Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur, as we know, he was pretty much engaged in interacting with modernity. He was raised as a Western, being in India, but he has English education. And he was pretty much creative in his inspiration. And of course, totally supported by deep insights and epiphanies he was having. He was really a mystic. He was not just like, okay, let's do like this and let's like just do things differently. No, he had very profound backing. But nonetheless, he had some different ways of approaching things, so that started to create some particular distance or differences of opinion among different, even between himself and his own guru, interestingly, between Bihari Goswami. Although there are different stances in that connection, again, that's another separate lecture. More than one lecture. As you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur instructed Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta to establish, to continue with his vision, if you will, and give that shape. So Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta did that, being in one sense, even more innovative, you know, and interacting with society in such a way, in a very like bold, revolutionary way, and somehow adjusting details for his presentation, like, okay, giving the Brahmin thread and restating the order of sannyas and emphasizing this notion of siksha parampara, which was a lot for the time. I mean, for us, that's normal. Yeah, like, okay, we did receive those notions from day one. But if you travel in time to that place in the world and the dynamics, that was like... And, I mean, the motto of the Gaudiya Math was totalitarian world against illusion. So you can have a glimpse about the spirit of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. Totalitarian war against illusion. Against all misconception of reality, all misconception of Krishna Bhakti, we are declaring war. He was pretty much in that spirit, no? And he had to, in order to accomplish what he accomplished. But again, in the context of those things, they are adjusting details. And in time, some of those things may create other dynamics that need like further adjustment in today's world. So for example, that particular stance that Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta took kind of created a very strong like difference, no, between Gaudiya Math. At that time it was only Gaudiya Math, not different missions coming from Gaudiya Math. Gaudiya Math and everyone else in the Gaudiya world. So that was pretty much intense. And again, I'm not saying, I'm not blaming Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. At the time were considerable irregularities in how other lineages were presented. I'm not saying that everyone else was deviated, because sometimes I've seen devotees saying that also. Like, there was nobody bona fide except Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. Mm-hmm. No, it's not like that either. Mm-hmm. But there was quite a lot of misrepresentation of the tradition, so he felt the inspiration and need to take a particular stance, which kind of created this type of difference. No, this was here, this is here. Not like giving shape to something from day one. You sometimes need to be a little bit like, okay, this is good, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. No, more black and white in one sense. Now, of course, it's not that he was a black and white person, but sometimes creating something from scratch requires some like concrete fences, if you will. No, so. So the point is that that had a purpose at the time that helped Gaudiya Math develop and so on. But also the point is, in time, how much that deserves to remain or needs repair, if you will, or needs attention in another way. And I think it needs a lot. But unfortunately, I feel that many, and again, with this, I'm not pointing at anyone, but in many cases, many of the followers of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta have kind of continued with his formula, which continue on some level continues working, because it was such an empowered, he was such an empowered personality. So although what he proposed had a lot of relative details, according limited to time, place, and circumstance, there was such an empowerment behind that even if you reproduce that formula for two generations, still works. Less, but still works. So we say, oh, working. So we don't need to change anything. Not people, money, temples, we can... So it's working. Again, not in the same way. And of course, one generation after another, they will be watered down and down, and at one point they will become totally irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And of course, we don't want to reach... to conclude that in that way. No, after 12 generations, like, what's going on here? So the point is that most of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta's, and again, I'm not criticizing that. Again, it worked. It was a structure that helped. Of course, eventually, as we know, Gaudiya Math expanded into so many sub-missions. I mean, nowadays, Gaudiya Math per se doesn't exist. It's not that there's one mission called Gaudiya Math. You have unending missions coming from the Gaudiya Math. And of course, each of them have made their own adjustments or moods. But in general, the formula keeps being reproduced on some level or another. Mm-hmm. And of course, on the other side, if you want to speak about traditional Paribar, sometimes that's the expression to speak about all that is not Gaudiya Math and its offshoots, traditional Paribars. Also, there are, again, different personality, but there's quite the other day I was speaking with one devotee, and he told me that he had somehow some form of, I don't want to call faith crisis, but something like, okay, where to go now in my Gaudiya trajectory. And he spoke with one senior Vaishnava, and he recommended you take initiation in some traditional Gaudiya Parivar. And he was telling me, like, he told me that, but actually I don't feel, although he feels some inspiration from the way they practice, he said, but also there's lots of narrow-mindedness and sectarianism in there. Mm. No? So it's not that all the things are only on one side of the equation. So problems are in both sides, and I personally feel there's a need of hopefully a further dialogue and gradual reconciliation of some level. I won't say that will happen like magically in one Keturi festival or something. It may take generations, because for some generations the opposite was invoked. Mm-hmm. For again, not necessarily even blaming anyone. Also, I don't want also to some simplistic Krishna's arrangement, but also he's there. But I think it would be an interesting dynamic to see a dialogue between these different groups of Vaishnavas. And of course, on top of that, then we have Srila Prabhupada and ISKCON, who is, like, of course, a very prominent offshoot from Gaudiya Math, that is totally massive. I mean, if you put all the Gaudiyas together, maybe they do not equate the number of members of ISKCON, if you will. Again, it's not a question of number of members, but it's a pretty prominent branch. So, and that also has its own pros and cons, as with everything that is big, and certain conflicts, inter-conflicts about, you know, how to proceed, what's the mood, and what Prabhupada wanted, and the regulative principles, and Raghunuga Bhakti, and what's that, and, you know, and different ideas. No? So I found that, no? For example, of course, there are a diversity among, when I'm saying ISKCON, I'm not saying everyone thinks the same way. Mm-hmm. But there are many devotees in that society who thinks we don't practice Raghunuga Bhakti. We practice Vaidhi Bhakti. We follow regulative principles, chant our rounds, and at the end of our life we go back home, back to Godhead or something like that. And other devotees will say, no, we practice Raghunuga Bhakti. That's what Mahaprabhu came to give to the world. But Prabhupada in the beginning emphasized this, and it's clearly so with some reason. So again, there's deep need for dialogue among ourselves, as I mentioned at the beginning of my book, no, that I felt that the Gaudiya Sampradaya is in deep, in urgent need of conversation with itself, basically. No? Well, before speaking even about, let's speak with someone else. No? In our present times, the Gaudiya Sampradaya is in urgent need for conversation with itself, as well as of ample room for freedom of theological thought in order to transcend the cognitive rigidity and tribal thinking that so much characterizes the approach of the novice, and so on.
Yeah.
Get my book. So again, I will say there are different schools. Some of them will be mostly engaged in outreach, like, for example, ISKCON. Mostly, again, in ISKCON there are different practitioners, but the main emphasis is maybe outreach. Other lineages are not at all about outreach, but are more like about different things. For example, you have someone like Satyanarayan Das Babaji. He's from the Gadadhar Parivar. And he's not about outreach in one sense, but also he's not about Manjari Bhav and Lila Smaranam and Ekadash. I'm not criticizing one thing nor the other. He's more about studying the books of Jiva Goswami and studying the Sat Darshan and learning Sanskrit and knowing the philosophy. So that's one mode, if you will. He has his institute in Vrindavan, and people go there and studies. And there are others, I don't know, if you go to Radha Kunda, many of them, they will be mostly focused on meditating on the Astakalya Leela of Radha and Krishna, and the receiving of Ekadash Bhav, and more like contemplative, like, if you will, not about, yeah, preaching, if you will, but solitary bhajan or something. Some others will be more about opening temples and preaching and distributing books. Different ways. You know, our Guru Maharaj somehow fits in between all that. No? Because again, it's not that it's, you have this, and this. No, you have personalities who have a little bit of this. No, more introspective in writing books, but also there is some level, some outreach, and there is, I mean, and again, I'm not saying this is better, this is worse, this is bona fide, this is not. There are so many things that are different from itself, but all of them are equally acceptable. But of course, each one of us has to fix their goal in one direction and go for it. Because if you like remain like taking too much everything from everyone, it kind of becomes a totally diluted thing. No? So we can learn about this diversity, appreciate that, not necessarily think they're all wrong except for me, but also according to our capacity of nourishing from diversity, because if we don't have that capacity, we may get confused. Because it's too many ways of doing the same thing differently, and you may be like, how I'm supposed to do it? No? Well, how your Guru Maharaj told you, that's the safe place. If you already have your Guru Maharaj, go in that direction. That's a way of, like, if you will, simplifying your mind. No, so, I don't know, some words. No? Many, many more things could be said. No? I feel like I've been just abstract and I didn't enter into the details, but just a general picture. If one goes to India, one really quickly, in 5 minutes, one realizes this. Because you walk one block, and in one block you have like 25 different missions or party bars. And you start to see a different tilak, different way of dressing, and tilak, and cloth, and chanting, and the songs in the book, and the, everything on some level, again, is different. So, but in a deeper sense, I think it's very crucial to retain that bigger picture notion. We all belong to the same family, because if not, very easy we can enter into this. No, and he was an offender to our guru, and he is an offender to our guru, and maybe some of those things happen. I'm not saying they didn't. I don't want to sound like hippie also, like, it's okay, let's embrace all of us and sing together in Sankirtan. But it's also a place to speak and clarify, and maybe there are some issues that are more type of generational baggage that we do not need to be carrying ourselves. Maybe it belonged to our previous generation. No. A guy was speaking about that with some second generation devotees in other places recently, and they were telling me, our parents have had some experiences in ISKCON with other sanghas, and they carry some baggage in that sense, which I understand, and they are dealing with that, but we don't want to receive that, if you will, that inheritance. It doesn't belong to us. No, we don't have to deal. We will have our own baggage for sure. So also that's, I think it's important to delimit all the things and not just, okay, whatever baggage previous generation is carrying, now it belongs to me. Right. And because you may take that baggage and try to deal with that out of context without knowing why it became a baggage for them and which were the reasons. And now you are carrying with that in a totally decontextualized, distorted way. And who knows what's the result of that? I mean, and everything can may become more and more like distorted and dysfunctional. And those things nonetheless speak to the world about who we are as Gaudiya communities. We want to, not to make a show, but hopefully to, and these things will be always in every religion, if you will, but dialogue, conversation is urgently required, yeah. So hopefully we can do something about it. And again, it's not that who is the superhero who will change the course of history, but just like each one of us, by beginning at home, being a proper example and having the maturity of open oneself to these topics and speak and hear and learn. Sometimes learning the history of these things is really maybe more helpful than trying to address all this in exclusively Siddhantic terms or something. you need sometimes to travel in time and understand why did he did this and he say that and they this happened 200 years ago. I mean, you have to understand. There are many books important in that connection to understand, I don't know, the times in which Bhaktivinoda Thakur was living, the times in which Bhaktivedanta was living, and those things help you. Oh, now it makes perfect sense why he said that. I mean, I already understood why on some level, but now that I grasp this bigger picture, oh, now it helps me appreciate him more, but also it helps me to understand more how I have to stop doing that now. Because probably it's a totally different cosmovision at present. So you appreciate that more, but that at the same time takes you to understand, I need to change that technique more. I realize more the need for adjusting those relative things. No? Anyhow, but that's a fascinating topic for sure. Okay. Something else? I have one question here from Lalita Saki. Mm-hmm. And Bhakti Rasa has a phase of second question. I mean, she said before, I have one more. She told me that also. So let's go with this one from Lalita Saki. It says, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur opens his Sriman Mahaprabhu Rastaka Liya Lila Smarana Mangala Stotram, which is 8 verses describing Mahaprabhu's Nitya Lila, saying, there's one like kind of introductory verse. Devotional service to the lotus feet of Sri Gauranga Mahaprabhu is far beyond the perception of Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Lord Seshanag, and the rest. But it is continually indulged in by the Lord's own devotees and is always available to other souls as well. How to properly understand, given that our Lord Brahma is looking for Sakyaras, and Shiva is the best of Vaishnavas? Yeah. So I will say this is like a classical expression. Now you will find in many verses this type of idea, like Brahma and Shiva and Sukha and Nara, not the end of Gaurarti, and so many songs, like they are totally overwhelmed and this is quite beyond their range. So it's a way of saying, not so much of referring to them as who they are, because again, they are there in Gaur Lila. I mean, you say this beyond Brahma, I say, but Brahma is there, Haridas Thakur. So it's more a way of saying, these are like the people who are considered like the topmost personalities in the universe and beyond. And what Mahaprabhu is giving is far beyond their perception, like implying this is the topmost thing of the topmost thing. No? These personalities, again, Vaishnava Nam Jatashambhu, who is Shiva, who is Brahma, and so on. But who is Mahaprabhu? No? And Mahaprabhu is the master of all of them, basically, if you will. And Brahma and Shiva are after that. Now, that tries to make this theological point also, because so many people is, I don't know, worshipping Brahma, or worshipping Shiva, or worshipping this or that Deva, without understanding who they are worshipping. No? So this is like trying to make this point. All those people or those personalities who are being worshipped by the people of this world are actually worshipping Sri Krishna, and Sri Krishna in his most stellar moment is Mahaprabhu. So how much he is being worshipped by them. And in that connection, all of them are coming in the Lila, no? Mahadeva, Advaita Charya, Brahma, as Brahma Haridas, and so on. Narad Muni, Srivas Thakur, I mean, they are all there. So the idea basically here is not so much that they won't be able to, or they're not able to get benefit from that, but to make this point of all the things that you generally consider to be topmost, they are after the real topmost deal, which is Mahaprabhu and what he's trying to give here. Okay. Back to rest.
So, I was thinking about codependency and
okay.
how, you know, it's defined as like someone who loses themselves in another person or who acts in a certain way so that they can be liked by other people or to please other people.
Mm-hmm.
So how, what is the mechanism or the thing that makes that dysfunctional as opposed to the proper way of being surrendered to a guru and wanting to please the Vaishnavas and wanting to give yourself fully in service in a pleasing way to others? What makes one the goal and one dysfunctional?
Mm. Okay. So, good question. So that's an interesting topic because yeah, for the untrained eye, the two may seem similar or even the same. So this is an interesting type of thing because these two things are actually polar opposites.
Mm-hmm.
All they seem the same.
Mm-hmm.
No, this type of this refers to this. This is not the only example, but there are so many of these that they seem the same how they play out externally, but when you train your eye to see them internally, they're actually the exact 180 degrees opposition. And as we were saying the other day, you can, one thing is to be a bhajanandi, and one thing is to be a spiritual snob. No? Snob, you say? No? No? I want my room and I want there and I want to see anyone and just may. No? Like I was sharing the other day this example of Thomas Merton, when Richard Rohr, who is a Franciscan monk, was speaking about Thomas Merton in his room, basically in Gethsemane, and some of the contemporaries of Thomas Merton were there and were feeling like uncomfortable with the praise of Thomas Merton. So Richard Rohr said, why they are uncomfortable when praising Thomas Merton? He's praiseworthy. So he asked to another god brother of his, and he said, no, the point is that when Thomas Merton was here, he was pretty much intense, and he will tell to many of these of them, he will tell, actually you come here to the monastery and you think you are contemplatives, but actually you are just introverts. No? Not just like criticizing, but just making a point when he appreciated, I mean, there's a difference between being contemplative and being introvert. The fact that you are introvert doesn't mean that you are contemplative. There's adhikar in between making the difference. You follow. It's not that, oh, I'm introvert, I think I can become a bhajanandi. Not necessarily. No? So this type of things, not that again, they may seem similar, but actually there's a big difference between the two. So of course this is one of those cases, no? Because codependency, as Bhaktiraj says, is like a type of, how to say, like circular relationship, no? When one person is needs the other person, who in turn needs to be needed.
Mm-hmm.
No, you follow? Mm-hmm. So I think that starts to show the dysfunctionality of that. No, I need you, and you need that. I need you. No, so we both need each other, but actually for our own particular agenda, for our own particular purpose. And although it may take externally the form of I'm emptying myself for you and you are giving yourself to me, that's not the real thing. No, actually that's a particular stance you take circumstantially according to how you need to be, how you need to extract from the other person for your own purpose, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, because in this codependent circle, you have one of the two persons sometimes who is the giver, who needs to, and the other one is the taker, who needs to be needed. So again, it seems that it's working, no? It's complementary. One is giving everything, the other is taking everything, making sacrifices, and the other one is like the enabler, who allows the other one, who whatever. But actually, at the behind the curtains, the two parties are just looking for what they need separately. No, they are not actually concerned about the other person. Although one may seem to give, the other may seem to take. Mm-hmm. The two are takers. technically speaking, because I'm giving to you because I need to be validated by you telling to me how much you need me, mm-hmm. and therefore, oh, I'm someone or whatever. No, you validate my sense of identity. So, and actually, I'm giving myself to you, so you give me what I want from you. No, at the end, I'm not concerned about you. I'm concerned that you give me what I want, that I don't know how to give it to myself. So I need you to give that to me, although it's not working either, but you think it's working. So you don't know how to give that to yourself, so you try to give yourself to that person, so that person gives you the thing that you don't know how to give to yourself. So at the end of the day, you are just expecting to receive your reward from that person. And that person the same. That person needs to feel someone depends on me, someone needs me. So it's not like, oh, I'm allowing you to exercise full giving towards me because I love you so much. No. No. In codependency, we are speaking. Mm-hmm. In that particular vicious circle. Hmm? In both parties, at the end of the day, the converging point is selfishness. Mm-hmm. Not like what I want from you. And the other person is the same. What I want from you. Although it takes different, again, packagings, how it plays out in the two sides of the equation. But the underlying motivation is, in one sense, exactly the same. It's just extracting from the other person what I need for me, for a separate agenda, if you will. So that's codependency, basically. No? And of course, on the other side of the equation, we have, I don't know, prem, bhakti, sharanagati, all these type of expressions that we hear. Something similar is going on, but totally different at the same time. Because, for example, Shastra says, priti visayananda tatastrayananda, which means, the pleasure of the object of love is the pleasure of the subject of love, of the shelter of love. Mm-hmm. So, for example, no? If Krishna is happy, Radharani is happy. To give a topmost example, for example. No? An extreme example we find from her. I think we shared the other days. No? When after the eighth verse in Sikshastakam, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there comes a series of an elaboration of what Sri Radha says in that last verse, that, you know, she's saying, Krishna may embrace me, he may kick me, he may do whatever he likes, but he's always my Lord. Mm-hmm. So that may sound like pretty dysfunctional. Like, no, you have to fight for your woman rights. No, don't let that lampata, that womanizer abuse you. No? You may put the project filter, gender filter or whatever, relativity. But actually, if you analyze her psychology, I mean, that's not the case. There's no codependency, there's no dysfunctionality. But she's saying this extreme thing. She says, if Krishna is happy without me, then I'll make all the arrangement to not be with him. Mm-hmm. Because I'm just addicted to his happiness. Like if you are addicted to heroin, okay, Sri Radha is addicted to Krishna, that giving pleasure to Krishna. Sorry to give the example, but like something like you cannot just like escape from that. It's like right. It's your life. It's like everything ends up converging there. No? So if Krishna is happy embracing me, I'm happy in his embrace. Not because I'm happy separately, because I know he's happy embracing me, and that's why I'm happy. But if he's embracing me and I realize he's not happy, somehow I will manage to get out from that embrace because he's not happy. So I don't want to cause the less discomfort for him. So that's an important point. No? I mean, and of course the idea here is also when we speak about codependency, we are speaking about two parties which are relatively empty, mm-hmm. and they need to fill their existential whole, if you will. But when we speak about Krishna and Sri Radha or devotee properly situated, we are speaking about people who is full. In them, they are full and they express their fullness in that loving interaction. No? For example, let's take the famous Rasa Lila of the Bhagavatam. Rasa Lila doesn't mean Krishna and the gopis get together because they are codependent and they need one another because they are I don't know, empty in life. I don't know what to do. I need someone to validate my sense of existence. Nothing like that. I mean, Bhagavan is Bhagavan. He's Atmaram, Aptakam, self-satisfied. He's Bhagavan. He has all these qualities. The gopis have prem. I mean, if you have prem, you are full. You are not empty. So they are getting together to celebrate the fullness. That's Rasa Lila. Rasa Lila is not getting together to fix their emptiness. They are getting together to celebrate their fullness. They are full, and they get together to celebrate that, and they get even more full. The fullness overflow. That's Rasa Lila, overflowing to the point of dancing and singing. Celebration is that, as Guru Maharaj will say, you are full. That's the very first word of the Rasa Panchadhyaya, the first five chapters of the Rasa Lila. First word, verse of chapter 29 says, Bhagavan api ratri, Bhagavan api taratri. So the first word of the Rasa Lila is Bhagavan, interestingly. Which means, because the whole story seems to be a teenage boy dancing with lots of girls at night in the forest. So it's like, So you have to put the whole narrative in context. So the very first word is Bhagavan. So Bhagavan means he who has sixfold opulences. One of them is supreme renunciation. So, yeah, he's dancing with the girl, but he's supreme renounce. I mean, he's not, again, materially attached, needy, empty, dysfunctional, codependent. He's totally renounced, not attracted to anything of that type. And despite that fact, he's dancing and celebrating with the gopis. So the point is, that must be of another, belong to another category altogether. Because he's Bhagavan. He's fully renounced. So there cannot be any type of codependency in the ordinary sense of the term. And of course, again, the gopis are made of prem, so how full they are. So they are just, the twofold fullness is just meeting together and overflowing. No? And technically speaking, on some other level, of course, we are not there, but that should happen the same to us, in the sense of when we serve, when we surrender, it should be out of fullness that we are doing that. In which sense I'm saying this? Like, we give ourselves to Sri Guru, for example. Hopefully that's voluntary. And there are degrees of that, no? Degrees of giving oneself. It's not just, yesterday I was a karmi and today I'm surrendered to Krishna. And okay, nothing in between. So if you give yourself to Sri Guru, to give an example, ideally it's because it's voluntary. And that voluntary surrender, before that, you have feel, I've received so much. So I'm so filled by all the grace, all the mercy, all the shelter, all the knowledge, all the affection, all the things that came from that side have filled myself. So I'm so full, not full with you, that I want to reciprocate. So you serve, you surrender, you give, but on the basis of fullness. Mm-hmm. You follow my point. Mm-hmm. So that's not that warranties that there is no codependency there. But if you don't have that type of fullness, if you don't feel that gratitude that some big thing has come, and you nonetheless give yourself forcefully for whatever reason, that may be a form of codependency for sure. Mm. In the context of bhakti, I mean, that can happen also. That you need, I don't know, the Vaishnava to validate you. Oh, how nice, very nice, boy, bravo, bravo. Oh, I love you so much. Oh, you did so nicely. But actually, you are using them to validate your lack of self-confidence. But actually, you are not feeling, I've been filled by them. So, and now I'm just trying to give back some of that overflowing that is coming because of their grace. So I'm trying to give as much as I can, as an attempt to do that. I mean, as we know, Krishna himself is trying to do that as Mahaprabhu. he feels I'm receiving so much from the gopis, I'm not able to reciprocate, but I will try my best. He tries. He tries really hard, really nice. Gaur Lila is there. And that's not codependency. Again, it's like the natural stance when you perceive, oh, so much is filling me. Huh? So I cannot just remain nice, thank you, but how do I give myself? You know? So again, when we feel, I'm saying this because that can happen in the name of bhakti. So that's a delicate thing, because and the question is important, because it goes even one sense beyond that this particular topic. But in the name of, I don't know, we can have psychological dysfunctionality in the name of surrender. We have seen that. Forcing ourselves to surrender, forcing others to surrender without the right reasons, without naturally, organically feeling called in that direction, or abuse in the name of humility. No? You have to be humble. No? Well, shut up. Don't think. Just say yes. No, or so many things. No? People who is really needs in need of treatment, but then you may think, maybe with good intention, but with lots of naivete, oh, maybe he's an avadut. He requires a visit to the madhouse. No? I mean, we have a dangerous philosophy in that sense. I mean, a very beautiful one, but if you don't know how to deal with that properly, you may make some connections which are not accurate in others and in yourself, and you can create a whole, like, dysfunctional version of Krishna consciousness, and you may be even convinced, like, we are almost getting Golok or something. And eventually you will be like, okay, Golok, Golok. No? So, So going back just to make full circle to the reply, yeah, there is an ocean of difference between codependency and love. In one, you feel the need to validate, to confirm your sense of identity by serving yourself and by reminding a self-centered idea and using everything with you in supposed center. That's codependency. And real spirituality is you need to validate your identity, but as who you really are, by serving the center, not by putting you in the center, no? And by giving yourself to the center in a comprehensive way. Like the Chaitanya Charitamrita says, Atmendriya Pritivam Chatari Valikam Krishnendriya Priti Chadhari Premanam. Famous line. So Atmendriya, calm or selfishness, selfish desire means that you have lots of desire for satisfying your own body, mind, senses. And prem means you have lots of desire to satisfy Krishna senses. In a very simple way, no? Like to conclude this idea, no? So that's the difference between codependency and prem. No? One has the ultimate converging point, our false sense of self, false ego, whatever, and false sense of necessities. I need him to validate my... And the other one has its converging point, our real self and real sense of necessity. No? So, I don't know if that helps. Thank you for the question. So, we're almost on time. There's one more question here online. If you have some minutes, we can address this one. So, this question comes from Jean-Claude Van Damme. So, we have famous actors here making questions. That's an interesting one. Maybe if you are very young in generation, you don't know what I'm speaking about, but whatever. Anyhow, there's a question, interesting question. It says, in connection to some of the things you have been speaking, why does Krishna come to earth as Mahaprabhu to experience Radha Bhav and try to understand her mood if he can experience that in Nitya Navadvip in a permanent form? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's clear the question? Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have mentioned something here and there before about Mahaprabhu and the Nitya Lila. So, why? Well, to begin with, of course, we have Nitya Navadvip, and as we mentioned the other day, on earth, Mahaprabhu is trying to taste Radha Bhav, and Chaitanya Charitamrita finishes describing the 8th verse of Shikshastaka, we quoted before, and Krishna Das Kaviraj says this verse was spoken by Sri Radha, like implying Mahaprabhu did it, he fully entered in Radha Bhav, he's successful. The Lila is, Gaur Lila is not a failure as Krishna Lila was. Something like that. So one may conclude, okay, he did it. But at the same time, you can, as an afterthought, think, well, but to taste Radha-bhava, I mean, Radha-bhava is fathomless ocean. So it's not that Krishna tasted Radha-bhava and there's nothing else to taste. So he can continue tasting that, and for sure he will. And for that, he needs a permanent situation in which he's only doing that, and that's what we call Nityanavadvipa. No? So it's an eternal lila when Krishna's only doing that forever. So it's not that in Nityanavadvipa Krishna is not Mahaprabhu. Krishna's Mahaprabhu is not tasting Radha-bhava. He is. No? It's not that he's only coming here to do that, and there he's doing, I don't know what, something else. Actually, if you study the Astakaliya lila of Sri Chaitanya, Sriman Mahaprabhu, not Sri Chaitanya, he's not Chaitanya there. I mean, he's constantly engrossed in Radha-bhava. You know? Throughout the day, he's coming and going, internal, external, half-external consciousness, mostly in Radha-bhava. So he's doing that for eternity. So that's one point to make. You know? He's tasting Radha-bhava in Nityanavadvipa. So, I mean, if I confirm that, then the question may come with further strength. So why then he's coming here to do that? Of course, no, natural reply will be, why not? I mean, there's so much to taste that he's tasting there and he continues tasting here. I mean, for me, that would be the most like natural, common sense reply that comes to my mind. I mean, it's not that because he's tasting that perpetually in Golok now, he's tasting it all either. No. So as much opportunities he has for doing that, he will take them. Because so of course on the same lineage we can mention some argument. Well, why does Krishna perform Braja Lila on earth? Because in one sense he's I mean he has his own Braja Lila in the apricot in Golok Vrindavan. What's the difference? What the need of that? Of course, many things could be said, but we could make a point also in complement to what I've already said. That, of course, we know that when Krishna comes on earth, many things happen that do not happen there. For example, he's born from the womb of Yashoda. You know, Kavi Karnapur will say this whole lila on earth is for Yashoda's sake because she doesn't have the joy of giving Krishna's birth to Krishna in the apricot. Krishna is always there, if you will. But here he's somehow the lila adjusts to the chronological unfolding of planet Earth. So there is time and sequence and Krishna is growing and crawling and doing so different, many different things till he reached the point of like Nitya Kishore, eternal adolescent. And he remains there, even though he remains on Earth for 125 years as an eternal adolescent. And in that context, as we know, Paritranaya, Sadunam, Vinashaya, Chaduskrita, he does some other things. You know, he establishes Dharma, kills so many demons, sets precedence in the world. I mean, that's part of the function, if you want to call the Yuga Dharma. So in connection to Mahaprabhu, one could say, yes, he's tasting Radha-bhava in Nityanavadvipa, but also he's coming on earth. Of course, we could say to establish Yuga Dharma as the Yuga Avatar, Harinam Sankirtan, and in this particular Kali Yuga, that Yuga Dharma is affected by what he's tasting. So one can connect his tasting of Radha-bhava on earth in connection to what he's delivering as an outcome of that in the form of that particular type of Harinam Sankirtan. But also his teaching to the world. He's coming as an acharya. He accepts sannyas, as we know, something that doesn't happen in Nityanavadvipa. And as Sri Krishna Chaitanya, he becomes the very example of what to do. No, as Krishna being a sadhaka, no, Krishna adopting the identity of a practitioner and giving the example of how to practice. For us to have a reference point and establishing the sampradaya, I mean, we wouldn't be asking this question if Mahaprabhu wouldn't have come on earth, basically. And because we wouldn't have Gaudiya Sampradaya and we wouldn't know about so many things that take us to make this question. So in one sense, the fact that you are making the question, the reply to a question is already included in your making the question. What takes you to make the question? The fact that he came here on earth and tasted Radha-bhava and taught by example. And he cultivated Radha-bhava in a systematic way, here, reaching starting from being a non-devotee, as we know, Nimai Pandit, eventually becoming a Vaishnav, and showing the symptoms of a Parama Vaishnav, becoming sannyas, teaching, traveling, instructing, also these things in the course of, at the same time, cultivating this Radhabhav more and more till the point of entering Gambhira and stopping being a public person for the last 12 years of his life. So all those things are not being performed in Nityanavadvip. All this sequence of teachings and example and things that we need. As the other day someone asked me, why in the Panchatattva mantra that we recite daily, the Panchatattva that we see in so many pictures, Mahaprabhu doesn't appear as a sannyasi in the Panchatattva painting, but in the Panchatattva mantra, he's called Sri Krishna Chaitanya. That's his sannyas name. So why we refer to him as his sannyas name and not as the name he will have in Nityanavadvip? It won't be Sri Krishna Chaitanya. He's not sannyasi there. We don't worship Mahaprabhu as sannyasi on the altar, because the altar is a portal into where we want to enter for eternity, and there he's not as a sannyasi. So the answer, as Guru Maharaj says, to begin with, that name Chaitanya is also in our Gaur Gayatri. We recite daily for those who receive Diksha. So Chaitanya is also there. So the idea is, first you have to go through Krishna Chaitanya, Mahaprabhu's Acharya Lila, Sannyas Lila. And then you have some hope to enter the Nityanavadvip when he will appear as Bishvambar Mishra, Gaur Sundar, Sachinandan, Gaur Hari. But first you have to go to all that his sannyas is trying to give us. So that's basically why he's coming here. And in the context of that, of course, he's tasting Radhabhav. Again, it's not just coming here for us and to teach the world something, and I'm missing my Radhabhav so much, what I'm doing here on earth. No. I mean, he cannot avoid tasting Radhabhav in the context of doing all those things, because, again, one thing is not separate from the other. What he's coming to give and establish is what he is about, what he's relishing for eternity. So that could be a way of replying also to your question. So I hope that helps. Okay, I think we already spoke like an hour and a half, so we can finish here. Thank you so much for your time. Questions? Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Radha Madhav ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Priman, Hari Gaur.